Welcome, cultists. It's the second week of October, which means week two of Silver Screens and Monster Month. And have we got a classic for you this time? Hot on the heels of last week's Gojira episode, Cult Classics is headed to the UK this time to see what we can unearth in the 1967 Hammer classic Quatermass and the Pit. So strap yourselves in for the next hour and change as we head underground. I'm DK, your guide on this year's tour of the macabre, eerie and downright weird. But as always, I'm not alone on this journey of discovery. This time I'm joined by not one, but two newcomers to the show. And for the second time this year, we have a married couple on Cult Classics. Not only that, but they're the writing and producing team of the Destination Yesterday podcast, the people behind the Lovecraft Inspired, which is quite apt for today's episode, Eyes for Investigate podcast. And so a big welcome to Michelle Perry Brooker and Neil Brooker.
Thank you.
Thank you, DK. It's good to be on.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Not a problem at all. We appreciate you joining us for this one. I mean, I have to ask, outside of your own productions, is this your first podcast?
Absolutely, it is.
Yes.
Oh, wow. So, yeah, first I've got to ask, what inspired you to create the show? How did you come up with the idea?
That's interesting. I think both of us have got different takes on what inspired us to do it. So, Michelle.
Well, during the lockdown, we discovered Lovecraft Investigations, and we got to thinking, I guess we could do that. No big competition, Julian Simpson, you know. Actually, you know, but we also had a bit of contact with him, not like he knows us or something, but I mean, he's very friendly and approachable on his sites, and you can put up little bits of I'm writing this, I'm writing that, or I'm thinking of doing this. And he always just said, don't just, you know, think about doing it, write it. So, you know, I did. Oh, well.
Have you regretted that decision since?
Not me. I think somebody else has regretted saying, if you write it, I'll produce it.
That feels very pointed.
It was an interesting experience, actually, putting together the technical side, which has effectively been what I've been doing on the show, is sort of all the audio editing, sound design, and composing and creating music for it. It turned into a lot of work, but it was worthwhile. And it brought us into contact with an absolutely brilliant group of people. We could not want a better cast, honestly.
Nice. Well, I mean, I often tell our listeners that we don't do this show because it's easy, but, you know, because we thought it would be easy. Did you guys run into any of that yourself as you went on? Was there ever a moment when you thought, you know, hold on, we've bitten off a little more than we can chew here? How much of a learning experience has it been?
For me, no learning bit at all, because I just write. And I, you know, he does the technical stuff. I'm on easy street. I could just keep writing and writing. On to you, darling.
Well, I mean, there were six episodes and two trailers, and the trailers got produced first. And I will say that by the end of the, or towards the end of the production, or midway through the production of the first trailer, I was thinking, I cannot do this. And amazingly, sort of 2 months and six episodes and two trailers later, I'm still thinking, I can't do this.
It is certainly a lot easier doing the writing side of things. I've found that myself. I leave the editing to people like Nick and Mike, and if not for them, this show would be up the creek. So, yeah, I can fully understand how sometimes you feel that you kind of took it in a direction that might be a little overwhelming, but so far, you've done a fantastic job.
Thank you. We could not have done it without the people supporting us. We are always incredibly grateful to them.
Yes, that's the other thing. You see, I wrote it, and he said he'd produce it, and then it was, are we going to do all the voices ourselves and use AI voices and stuff? Because we only had one friend who wanted to be in it. So I just, put up a plea on the HPLHS Facebook page there, and yeah, people kept flooding in, and I kept saying yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, it seems to have gone gangbusters, your little recruitment drive. So
I'm up to 23 cast members.
Wow.
And by the time we actually were going into production at the start of December, we actually had more people than there were roles. So we've actually had to sort of tell people, okay, we can't give you anything now, but for the second season, we'll make sure you've got something.
With this in mind, I mean, have you always been fans of the Cthulhu mythos? I mean, what is it that intrigues you about the concept?
For me, it is absolutely, it's an amazing cosmology. You know, it has always a kind of occurred to me that it's, you know, like reality doesn't care what you believe, kind of. It's
stealing.
Yeah. But honestly, the best stories are stories that sort of are not anthropocentric or you know, terrestrial centric or whatever you want to say, but which sort of convey this ethos that the universe is so big, you are tiny and insignificant.
Yes, you know,
even as a species kind of thing. So that appealed to me. And also the fact that although the continuity is a little bit loose, and I don't think H.P. Lovecraft desperately thought, you know what, I'm going to tighten this up and turn it into a coherent entity, I think actually is still very kind of, it fits together well. That's just my take on it.
For me, it's just within the whole genre that I always loved. I mean, when I was 9, I was reading, well, Dracula, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, all the Edgar Allan Poe, and my favorite Shakespeare novels at 9, were things like Macbeth, you know, I'm just a real bookaholic, and always writing too, songs, poems, whatever. So in 1991, around there, I've heard Walter Koenig, Star Trek Chekhov, doing a reading of The Rats in the Wall. And that's the first I really knew of H.P. Lovecraft.
And it kind of sucked you in from there, yeah?
Yep. Mm.
So as we're speaking, what's Destination Yesterday putting out at the moment?
Dagon.
Yep, Eyes for Investigate, Dagon. We have got a planned schedule for a number of stories, but where we take it from there after that, I don't know, once we've actually reached the end of that.
So after Dagon goes, we get Color Out of Space, and then it's, what, Hidden next, our original?
I was thinking that actually that might fit in better between Color Out of Space, between Dagon and Color Out of Space. But
you think so? Okay.
I'm letting set the times, letting you set the timeline on that.
Well, and then we have
Dreams in the Witch House.
So, I'm just worried. Well, not worried, I shouldn't say that. It's not that way. Dagon has a character in it that is important in Color Out of Space, so I was sort of going to...
Mm.
But yes, I can see why we should go back to Hidden, since it takes off actually from the initial ending we had that we changed. Well, I changed for Shambler from the Stars. So I changed the ending at pretty much the last minute. Somebody had recorded it and sent it to me thinking, hey, I'm done. I said, no, I changed it. Sorry.
Oh, dear.
Here it is.
So, thanks for that, guys. And yeah, you can listen to the Destination Yesterday podcast, including Eyes for Investigate, wherever you get your audio podcasts. I will put the link in the description. So all of you out there in the real world, I urge you to click those links and check out the show for yourself. Before we press ahead, one thing that I do have to ask you both. It's our standard question for any newcomer to the show. It gives us here and the listeners a glimpse into where you're coming from. Kind of a desert island disc choice. If you had to choose one cult movie of any genre to label as your favourite of all time, what would that be and why?
Michelle?
I think the first thing that came to my mind was My Man Godfrey with William Powell. It's so funny. I just love it. I mean, I could quote from it for ages, and Neil knows I still do all the time. Especially your favorite song, yeah, right, darling? Yeah. And I was number 9. So, I love screwball comedies, and I hope a fair bit of comedy comes through, too, in our podcast, despite it being H.P. Lovecraft inspired.
Nice. And what about you, Neil?
I would say, I wouldn't necessarily describe it as a cult movie, more as a genre movie, but I think the one that made the most impact on me was Kubrick's 2001. You know, I wanted to see that film for years and years and years when I found out about it, because all the screenshots from it and things were absolutely amazing. It looked exactly like a space movie should look like, and I was a big sci-fi fan. I finally saw it, and I just thought, wow, this is absolutely exactly what I expected. Love that film to pieces. But if you're looking at more sort of culty films, then I think actually my favorite might just be Underworld.
Oh, the vampire one.
Yeah, absolutely. Big vampire fan.
Nice. So, with that in mind, we'll get on to today's movie. Quatermass and the Pit, or 5 Million Years to Earth, as it's also known, is a British science fiction movie from Hammer Film Productions and a sequel to the Quatermass Experiment and Quatermass 2, all of which were based on the BBC TV serials written by Nigel Neal. The story centres on the discovery of ancient human remains buried at the site of an extension to the London Underground station Hobbs End. Now, it's directed by Roy Ward Baker. The film stars Andrew Keir as Professor Bernard Quatermass, replacing Brian Don Levy, who played the role in the two previous movies, along with James Donald, Barbara Shelley, and Julian Glover. Now, Neil wrote the first draft of the screenplay in 1961, but difficulties in attracting interest from American co-financiers meant the film would not go into production until 1967. The screenplay is largely faithful to the television original, though the plot was obviously condensed to fit the shorter running time of the film. The original BBC serials were not shown for the most part overseas. As a result, Quatermass was unknown to most non-UK audiences, resulting in Fox releasing it under the name 5 Million Years to Earth. It opened in November 1967 to generally favourable reviews and remains well regarded. It's also developed a reputation as a cult classic over the years and counts the director John Carpenter among its fan base. And Quatermass and the Pit can currently be found on multiple streaming platforms dependent on your location, as well as in the standard reliable physical format. Now, I first came to this one when I was quite young. I mean, they were showing it late one night on the BBC, and I stayed up to watch it on the little portable in my bedroom. I wasn't sure what to expect. Honestly, I think it was my first Hammer film. I hadn't seen any of the Quatermass serials before this, though I was familiar with the name. I believe I read a chapter of a Quatermass story in a British comic book, Warrior, I believe. I could be wrong on that one, so please don't hang me, for listeners. It intrigued me. It certainly wasn't what I expected. And I remember being extremely unsettled by the premise, so much so that I rewatched it when they repeated it a few months later. I mean, it seemed to be on every few months on the BBC back then. Anyway, I've been a fan of it ever since that first viewing, and it led me to the Quatermass series themselves, so how about you guys? What are your memories of this, and when did you first see it?
I was about 10, maybe 11 years old, and I have a sister who's 6 years older than me, and she used to get me up to watch things with her. She was trying to educate me. So she woke me up and said, come on down, watch the movie. It's going to be on in a few minutes. So she goes and sits in her chair, which is near the TV, the TV's in the corner of a room, and, you know, and her chair's, you know, there. And then there's a couch. I sat on the couch. I found it very scary anyway. And then it got to the point when they were bringing out the bodies, you know, out from the spaceship. At that point, that's what my little avatar is all about. A flock, shall we say, of five or six silverfish darted out from behind the TV, and my sister bolted for the stairs and said, "You can turn the TV off." And I absolutely have no memory of what I did after that. I don't know what I did.
You blocked it out through traumatic experience.
Yes, I don't think, I mean, obviously I must have got out of the rec room somehow. I doubt I turned the TV off. But I know I saw her leaving her little sister in this recreation room full of silverfish.
Oh, wow.
They're like two inches long.
You can't really watch this now without remembering that.
God.
Oh, dear. It's almost like a 4DX showing. It's...
Yeah.
What about you? What
yeah,
about you,
my
Amelia?
Story is a lot more. Actually, it's much more down to earth. It's very much like yours, except possibly I would think maybe 10, 20 years earlier. Yeah, it was sort of bedroom late night watching one time when I was about 11 or 12. So we're talking 73, 74 time. My mother, whenever the subject came up of the BBC TV series, her face would soften, her eyes would grow large and almost dreamily. Yeah, that's brilliant. And I was like, okay. And here's young me sort of filtering this information away, because I was just drinking in all this information and just sort of saving it for reference later. Then it was indeed shown on BBC, and so I sort of sat down and watched it one night, and I just thought, wow, this is amazing. It's absolutely great. It's exactly, you know, again, one of those things that hoped it would be. It absolutely fulfilled it.
Now, I mean, would you say it's one that you rewatch with any regularity?
From time to time. It's not something that, you know, you'd want to watch kind of every week or anything like that. But it's something I always look forward to with a great deal of pleasure when it does come to watching it. When I knew we were going to be discussing it, I just thought the time has come and I'm looking forward to seeing it. And you were absolutely right in saying that it is actually incredibly faithful. The movie is incredibly faithful to the BBC TV series, the original serial. It makes this one, I think, perhaps a bit of an odd one, because this is a cult movie which actually is almost inextricable from its source material, I think.
I've got to say, the writing on this one is, to me anyway, it's impeccable. It's one of those films, and when you consider that the majority of it takes place on maybe two sets, it's mostly people just having conversations with each other. It never lets go. It grips you from the start, I find. I mean, you know,
yes.
Your mileage may vary.
Great
but
pace.
And I think Nigel Neal was just a fantastic writer to be able to get these things together.
Mm.
Should I mention here that Dagon and what's the next one? Colorado Space both have Nigel Neal elements. And we are drawing on the whole Quatermass thing.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, I'm getting more and more intrigued as this goes on. Now, you're on about the, you know, it's very faithful. Obviously, I mean, the main casualty of the running time, I think there was a removal of a subplot involving a journalist. And, the climax was also altered with Roni using a crane to shot out the Martian influence, wearing the TV one. I believe he throws a metal chain into the pit.
Yeah.
A metal chain with a fire grate attached.
Yeah.
And I can kind of see that, because It's a matter of scale, isn't it? A TV show can more or less get away with something like that, but on a big screen, you really want this sort of huge climactic ending with a massive great crane just tipping over and...
Well, it swings around, actually.
And, yeah, that's right.
The thing
right.
is, with the iron grate and the chain, I can't imagine you could throw it high enough, really. So it had to be something bigger. I mean, I accept it in the TV thing, don't get me wrong, but yeah, it must not have been up very high for him to be able to throw that.
Yeah. I mean, the closing scene of the TV series, that's obviously been changed as well with the TV serial. He pleads with humanity to prevent Earth becoming the second dead planet, which, you know, that was dropped. Yes. In favour of the shot of Quatermass and Judd sitting alone and, you know, the devastation yes. around them. And I love that. I think it leads to a very ambiguous kind of ending.
Yeah, I agree. And times change, don't they? And honestly, while the message at the end of the TV serial, I think, holds true and still holds true today, but at the same time, it can come across as a little bit preachy. That was Hammer's business. They weren't really interested in necessarily going with that stronger message. I've noticed with a number of their films, particularly when they're looking, and I couldn't quote you one offhand exactly, but the ones that are sort of set in a more contemporary setting, like The Nanny and films like this, do have these kind of downer question mark endings.
Yeah. I'm going to ask both of you, because obviously one of you is from the UK and one of you is from further afield, shall we say. Is that just a uniquely British kind of thing? It's been brought up in the show before that we feed on this kind of misery because we're British. So I'm going to come to you, Michelle. What do you think to these kind of endings?
Well, I'm from Ontario in Canada, which is the loyalist area of Canada. And of course, all the shows I grew up with were like, you know, Last of the Summer Wine, Only When I Laugh, To the Manor Born. So, I mean, you can kind of see that why we're sometimes referred to as more British than the British. So no difference for me, you know. Might as well be from here.
You're just as pessimistic as the rest of us.
Yeah, except that we tend to be pessimistic and yet very silly.
Well, I mean, let's be fair. This is the entire basis for Monty Python.
Yes, well, that's another thing I grew up with, was Monty Python.
Nice. Yeah, I love this ending. I do appreciate the TV one, the preachy one, as you said, Neil. But yeah, I just love the fact that it's... To me, this one is a lot more haunting.
Yeah, definitely. I think you're probably right. We do leave movies on this sort of question mark, you know, where do we go from here? How do we build this better world kind of thing?
So, yeah, apparently the script was sent to John Trevelyan at the BBFC in December 66. And Trevelyan replied that the film would require an X certificate. And he complained about the sound of the vibrations from the alien ship, the showing of the Martian massacre, the scenes of destruction and panic, and the image of the devil. It's very odd because I would describe this as a subtle horror movie. It comes out the gate and it doesn't try to shock, it doesn't try to gross out its audiences. However, by the time it reaches the end, there is so much chaos and destruction that's been wrought. And it's just such an about turn. I just wonder what you guys think to that with regards to Neil's writing.
Yeah, it does really find a seam between a number of typical horror genres, if you like. I mean, it's not quite a sort of monster movie, which was standard Hammer fare. It's not quite a blood gore-fest kind of movie. In fact, it's very much not. And it's not quite a psychological horror, but it somehow manages to fit in between all of those. Go on.
I was just looking at what it's listed as, and it says genres, horror, mystery, sci-fi, thriller.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's not very easily pigeonholed. And no. I'm wondering if that could be one of the reasons for its allure, because I think when you're first exposed to this, you're not quite sure where it's going. Mm. I do love that. Even now, I mean, I've seen it so many times, but so I'll put it on and I'm just captivated.
Yes, that's the other thing, is we've got the DVD set of the Quatermass Experiment, Quatermass 2 and Quatermass in the Pit, and I said to Neil, we'll just leave this out because we'll be watching the other ones now.
Yeah, that is the BBC serials. Oh, yeah. Should add.
Yes. And also, of course, there was the live one done in more recent years. Yeah.
The one with Tennant and Gaitis.
Yes.
Yeah, I remember watching that one.
Julian Glover's wife.
Really?
Yes, she wanted to be in it as a sort of, you know, little thing, because he was in that one, and so she wanted to be. Yes, yeah, so his wife's a reporter in it.
Kind of like Sheila Staple in this one.
Yeah.
I do like the performances in this. I do think Julian Glover is. I don't know. I don't really. When someone mentioned me, Julian Glover, I don't see him as comedic timing, but there's a line in this. And it just gets me every time. It's when Sladen is preparing his drill.
Yes.
And he says, I did steal armor plating within 6 inches thick. It was legal. A boat got shut in a strong room. But I got him out. It was a secret job like this one. And Julian Glover says, then I'm glad you don't talk about it.
Yes, it is beautiful, isn't it?
It is, which, I mean, Neil's dialogue and... Julian Glover's performance delivery. In this, I just think, it's just perfect.
Actually, and that is delivered so correct, using stereotypes, I have to say, but at the same time, it comes across as absolutely perfect. This is what this high-ranking military officer in the circumstances would say, and the way they would say it. I thought it was absolutely perfect.
Yeah, I mean, there are some good performances in this. Andrew Keir, Barbara Judd. How do you think it compares to the original? And for that matter, how, you know, especially Andrew Keir, how he compares to Brian Donlevy in the previous two?
I'm not as familiar with the Brian Donlevy performances, I will admit. But I think they both brought something pretty good. Well, pretty unique and amazing to the character, which shows that the character of Quatermass can be interpreted differently, and that's absolutely brilliant. It's got to be an actor's dream to sort of have that character where you can bring your own take to it. You're talking Hamlet and things like this here.
I mean, various books on Hammer claim Roy Ward Baker originally wanted Kenneth Moore for the role, but apparently was vetoed by Hammer bosses. And then Baker went on himself on record later to state that, in his opinion, Moore wouldn't have worked as Quatermass, and Hammer were right to have vetoed that suggestion. Apparently Andre Morel, he was also asked to reprise the role the TV series, but he declined. Anthony Quayle apparently was considered. Andrew Keir was cast. Now, of the three Quatermass films, apparently this is the only one that Nigel Neill personally liked. Apparently he was much happier with Keir's performance than he had been with Brian Donlevy. He described Donlevy as a former Hollywood heavy gone to seed. And these are just claims, don't have a go at the podcast people. He claimed that for much of the filming of Quatermass 2, Brian Donlevy was drunk much of the time, to which, the director Val Guest repudiated it. Val Guest apparently was approached to direct this one, but had to drop out, leading to Roy Ward Baker. Yeah, how true the stories are, I'm not sure. Because, I mean, apparently, despite not connecting with Roy Ward Baker, Andrew Keir felt that the cast and crew on this one gelled together, you know, extremely well as a unit.
Yes. I've seen lots of behind-the-scenes pictures, and they're having a ball.
Yeah. I'm not sure if you guys know it. I presume you'll know about this, because you're infinitely more knowledgeable on Quatermass than I am. But he reprised the role of the professor in the Quatermass Memoirs, which was a 5-part docudrama, which again was scripted by Neil and transmitted on Radio 3 in 1996.
I was vaguely aware of that. It's not something I knew concretely, but yeah, I was kind of aware of it. But yeah, I need to track that down.
Yes, I didn't know about it.
Everybody's going to be rushing to check that out now after this.
Oh, I will be too.
Yeah, Julian Glover apparently had to perform his own stunts in this one, including the scene where Colonel Breen falls, you know, actually into the pit. Once his face resembles your average margarita pizza. Noel Howlett, who was the vicar in this, he was the only actor apparently to appear in the Quatermass and the original Quatermass and the Pit. Although he didn't play the same part. He played the vicar in the TV series and the librarian in the film. Is that correct?
That's right.
See, this is research is paying off, people. So yeah, what did you guys think? Was there a standout performance? How did you feel Keir handled the role of Quatermass?
I thought he was great. I thought he was perfect.
Yeah, absolutely.
He owned it.
He gave space to his fellow actors. And that was also really, really good. I mean, it was not a sort of a diva performance, as it were. And I think they do work incredibly well as an ensemble. Having had an experience now of having, you know, of people sort of pulling together these sort of ensemble pieces, it really works nicely. Is the best way I can put it. It just feels organic. It feels as if everybody is the role that they're playing and that they all interact in exactly the way that those people would interact.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, James Donald, I'm a big fan of his anyway. He's just brilliant.
Yeah.
I don't even mind the fact that he's not Canadian, when originally the character was a Canadian.
Yeah. Played by a guy named Cess Linder, who actually is a Canadian actor. No longer with us, sadly. And that was one of, I think, the other major losses in translation from the small screen to the big one, because it was very clear that to me that Nigel Neal had done that deliberately, because as we see when things start getting chaotic, Rone is not affected by that. All the craziness going on, and given the whole sort of theme of otherness running through the film and Nigel Neal's original idea behind Quatermass and the Pit, it kind of made sense to me that you know, having this Canadian character was more appropriate in context, and that was kind of lost when they cast James Donald as Rone, because, you know, it's just another Brit, as it were.
Yeah.
Just another Brit.
Well, yeah, indeed.
Rich on the river, quiet. Come on.
I'm sorry if that sounded dismissive. mean it that way.
As you said, I do think it is very much an ensemble piece with those four main characters. I mean, obviously, Quatermass headlines the thing, but it's just as much Roni's movie and Barbara's movie as it is Quatermass.
Yes.
At the end of the day, it is Roni that, you know, saves the day. And I do like the fact that, yes, he's obviously there as the antagonist, but Julian Glover as Breen, he's not entirely unsympathetic. He's not stood there, you know, twirling a moustache, as it were. He is, as you say, acting like a British officer would in those kind of situations.
Between the serial and the movie, they toned that down slightly, because the TV version of Breen is really shouty. And there are good reasons for that. He's confronted by something that he doesn't understand, and he absolutely is terrified of the unknown and looks to rationalize it in any way that he can. But all the same, if it, his world is virtually coming apart, as it were. All these strange concepts and the idea that there are these aliens and they may be responsible for genetic experiments which create or enhanced
we owe our existence to a bunch of apes.
Yeah, you know? Basically.
We do not. People will not accept that.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that...
Oh, insects, excuse me. I said apes to a bunch of insects, you know.
Yeah, that portrayal of Breen, I think, made sense in that context. But I think it would have been just a bit too over the top for the film. I think Julian Glover's performance is a little more understated. I think the film benefits from that a lot.
Yeah.
Personally.
I honestly think that of all the major players, they do... It is understated performance from kind of all of them. And I think that works to the benefit of the movie because it's very much a Chicken Little situation, but you don't have people acting anything less than professional.
Totally.
Perfect.
Totally.
Yeah. And you know, coupled with Neil's writing, and even now, some of the Neil's writing, I just think is brilliant. I mean, you know, just taking this line out of it, and you know, the will to survive, it's an odd phenomenon. Roni, what if we found out the Earth was doomed, say, by climatic changes? What would we do about it? And Roni just replies, nothing, just go on squabbling as usual.
Yeah.
And it's just so, it hits the nail squarely on the head. I just can't fault Neil's writing. And as a big fan of, you know, anybody that listens to this show will know I'm a big fan of John Carpenter. To find out that John Carpenter is himself a fan of Neil, that's a testament to me.
Yes.
So, yeah, with regards to... So we've covered pretty much the direction and the acting and the writing. Is there anything that you guys would like to bring up with regards to that we might not have touched upon?
For me, it's interesting that the censor's office complained about the sound the sort of sound effects used. I thought, yeah, this is really, really good. And I was actually, with my audio editing sound design hat on, I was busily trying to figure out what they did and how they did it. I just thought, yeah, this is really, really good. In the TV version, the BBC Radiophonic Workshop had provided the effects.
Yeah.
And when I think of Hammer, the sound effects of that nature is not the first thing that sort of springs to mind. So somebody did some very imaginative work there, I think.
Yeah, it is very effective. It does kind of become overpowering, but I can't see why they would insist on that being one of the reasons why it should be given an X certificate.
It's interesting, isn't it?
Yes, I said not suitable for children or people of a nervous disposition.
Yeah, which is pretty much anything on TV these days.
Yes.
So yeah, MGM's Boreham Wood Studios were used due to lack of space at Elstree Studios, and apparently because of this, the sets at MGM were very empty. There wasn't a lot of studio space booked up at that one, so the crew and the cast, you know, formed like a little unit. And Roy Ward Baker says it's one of the happiest shoots of his career.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Well, it shows though. It does show.
Yeah, I think it imbues it with a kind of atmosphere. I do keep singing its praises, but it is very much unlike a lot of even horror movies of that time.
Yeah, definitely. You know, it really felt... Yeah, I know that they made or adapted the previous two Quatermass serials as well, and occasionally made forays into scenarios set contemporarily, so sort of in the current day, in the modern era. Hammer's stock in trade was obviously very much gothic horror, you know. Yeah. Sort of Central Europe, forests, carriages, vampires, and etc. You know the scenario. So yeah, it did feel as if they were stepping out of their comfort zone, and yet they did it with a good degree of aplomb, which I think does come down, well, to obviously to everybody working behind the scenes, but I think Roy Ward Baker probably did a dang good job with that.
Yeah. Weirdly enough, for eagle-eyed viewers, in the London Underground, there are a few posters from other Hammer projects.
Yes.
There's ones for The Reptile, The Witches, Dracula, Prince of Darkness, as well as a poster for My Fair Lady and Hotel. So.
And Sex and the Single Girl. We can't forget that. Come on.
Now, that is interesting because Dracula, Prince of Darkness, if I'm not mistaken, is the Dracula that was issued that year in 1967. So it would have been very current.
It's listing it as 66, but it's around the same production time. So okay. So there's kind of some cross-advertisement going on there. Also in this cinema.
Yes.
As far as special effects and production design go, it's not overly laced with special effects, but I think what is there still holds up reasonably well. And I'm thinking specifically of the devil on the London skyline and the organic nature of the ship when it starts pulsating. Maybe not so much the scenes, the memories of the ritual killing on Mars.
Right,
But certainly the more present day effects. I just wondered what you guys thought to the effects on this one.
One thing I'd kind of noticed was sort of in the scenes leading up to the climax, you've got scenes of houses sort of falling down and things like this. I did notice they were a bit modelly.
But I said all they needed to do was shoot them from a lower angle because they had left too much sky over them. That made them look tiny and fake. So if they brought the angle down, that would have looked really good because they crumbled well. You know, it all worked good. But other than that, I really love everything about it. I love the ground shaking under the guy when he's lying there, and the way the dishes and things fly. I mean, they really do feel like they just shoot out from it, unlike in the serial where it does look like they've been tipped over and someone's throwing them. You get that feeling. And the way things are floating in the serial, again, it looks pretty mild, whereas in the movie, I mean, the way things are flinging around, and I can't see any strings, and I always notice the strings and think, this helps me to not be scared because it's so fake. But this movie, it doesn't look fake. And that's the other thing, it really gets me because it seems also plausible. Like, tomorrow, if in the news it was, we're just digging in London to do something, and look what we found. I think, oh, bugger. No.
Having said that, with the news headlines over the last couple of years, I think most people will go, okay, what next?
Yeah.
What do you guys think to the insects, as it were?
Actually, I think they're really well constructed. I think it's really convincing, presumably puppets or whatever they're props.
The way they're displayed within the hull looks really good is the thing. It looks, it's like nothing you'd ever see. So, it's alien.
Yeah, I remember being disappointed when I first watched it that they look, obviously they look so pristine when they're in the ship. And then once they take them out and they're oozing, green yogurt.
Well, like I said, they suddenly, with the air of London, hey, everything goes like that in a few minutes.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
And so, actually, yes. Sorry, I'm just going to make a quick point there. Again, something that was excised, presumably because, they were shaving down the script to fit it into an hour and a half runtime. But in the serial, when Sladen's drill goes through the bulkhead of the alien's compartment, they mention that actually there's a strong inrush of air. Therefore, they were in a vacuum, in which case they would not have decomposed even after 5 million years. And that did not get translated into the film. So
as an explanation
it is that kind of strange, you know, leaves the audience wondering, well, why is this? And maybe that sense of disappointment as well.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, in the series they make big point of the fact that they're catching up on all the decomposition that would have happened.
Yeah. I guess you know, you can't have everything.
No.
I will point out, going back to what you said, Michelle, with regards to, you know, everything floating around, I did like the shots specifically within the hull of the ship where the gravity starts failing and everything starts flying around. I think that was done really well.
Really good, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, we'll go on to the sound design. Obviously, the soundtrack was composed by Tristram Cary, who long-time BBC viewers will recognise. They requested both orchestral and electronic cues from Cary in order to have a choice of scores. He provided around 30 minutes of symphonic music plus a couple of electronic pieces to represent the Martian threat, though apparently much of it was lost during post-production, editing and recutting.
Mm.
So it was occasionally, at that point, replaced with stock tracks, which is a shame. It would have been nice to have, heard the original pieces.
Yeah, definitely.
Yes, I thought some of it when I was just watching clips today on YouTube to remind myself of bits. I thought, oh God, that's very horror, Hammer horror, that bit of music. And so I thought, I didn't really notice it when I was watching the film. But when you take the chunk out of context, the little scene, it was so obvious.
Yeah, there's some really good sound design. And again, we're going back to what you mentioned earlier, Neil, with, you know, the vibration from the ship itself.
Wonderful.
Yeah, and it was really nice that at that particular point where the ship is really starting to vibrate very strongly, in order to sort of go with the general chaos that's going on, all the people running everywhere and the violence and things like that, the score becomes really discordant with a lot of high register instruments, which really complement the sort of low level thrumming of the ship. And it just builds up almost like a multi-layered chord, which is somewhat discordant and really plays on the nerves of the audience.
Yeah. Yes.
And helps build up that tension and really complements all the craziness going on as well.
Yeah, and when you know, at the end where the, you know, inverted commas, horned devil is above the skyline, the effects at that point, I just think it's really unnerving still.
Yes. Mm.
And then, of course, it goes into the orchestral score, which to me adds to that haunting ending where it's just showing Clayton and Barbara.
Yeah.
I think in most senses, I think everybody on this came together and made something that, to me, I mean, I like Hammer films, but this is a standout, and I think this carries over almost to modern day, whether it's the pseudo-contemporary setting or just how it's been handled. I think it holds up well today where, you know, with the best will in the world, and as much as I love Hammer, a lot of them don't.
Yes, true.
Definitely.
Yeah, with regards to, you know, how it's gone on since its release, the legacy. Obviously, there was a fourth serial, The Quatermass Conclusion, which was condensed and released into cinemas. Again, it was directed by Roy Ward-Baker, but I believe it was John Mills who played Quatermass in that one.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Would you say that one held up?
No, I don't like John Mills as Quatermass. I like John Mills, but I don't think he's the right person for Quatermass.
That's fair enough. I mean, I don't know how familiar you are with other movies over the years. It's been suggested that the Tobe Hooper 1985 movie Life Force is largely a remake.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
I'm aware of Life Force, but
I
think I've seen it even. But
Facebook. Yeah, Patrick Stewart, I believe, in that one.
Oh, well, I'm going to have to look up that then, because I love Patrick.
And as you know, I've mentioned a couple of times during this, John Carpenter, he lists this movie as one of his favourites, and it influenced his own film, Prince of Darkness. Carpenter, he then recruited Neil for the original screenplay for the Tommy Lee Wallace sequel and last year's cult classic special, Halloween 3, due to being such a fan.
Wow.
He would also reuse the name of Hobbs End for the fictional town in which Sutter Kane resides in Carpenter's movie In the Mouth of Madness. So, yeah, big influence on John Carpenter's work there.
Wow.
Yeah.
And, yeah, in the late 90s, it was announced that the director, Alex Proyas, who directed 1994's The Crow, which is getting its own remake, was to do a remake of this one, but it then failed to materialise. Mm. I'm just wondering what you guys think to this whole remake, reboot thing. I mean, if they remade Quatermass, how do you... I mean, you know, you mentioned earlier the modern retelling, I mean, and even that now is going back 20 years. Would it succeed? Would they alter it irrevocably to the point where, you know, it would be all CGI?
It's terrible, because I was going to say, I hope it wouldn't lose that wonderful Britishness. But I mean, it's got this, is it a warmth that goes with that movie that, like you say, of everyone working so well together, and the sound, everything being, it's just right. It still affects you. So why do you fix something that ain't broken?
Mm.
And I was just trying to go through my head, who would play Quatermass? What would they do to Quatermass? He's an old fashioned type of character. So I'd be very concerned what they do. It might be great, you know. When they did that remake of Quatermass 2 there with Tennant and the bunch, I loved that. That was great. But, you know, it just depends. I know they could pull together a cast if they wanted to pull together the right one, cast it properly, but would they? Or would they go for, oh, this person is big at the moment, so let's put them here, let's put this one here. So,
yeah, I think there's always a danger of that. And, you know, when it comes to things like, you know, the insects and, you know, the Mars scenes, they could just go overboard with the CG and things like that. And that's always worrying to me. I'm a big advocate for practical effects, but I know what studios are like these days.
Yeah, it might be good to bring in a new audience, but I watch these old things. I mean, I have all my life.
This one's pretty much 60 years old at this point. I mean, how do you think it compares to movies today? Do you think it holds up alongside, you know, what studios releases modern horror?
When you try to compare those, they're very different beasts, aren't they? And I think you actually have to view it through that lens, is that, you know, it's a product of its time, and as the times when it was absolutely amazing, and making that kind of comparison, it's like trying to compare oranges and apples.
The other thing I think is that because it's a rather down-to-earth film, I mean, you know, it's supposed to be what's happening in the moment sort of thing, in that time, that makes it really absolutely right. You know, you wouldn't want to change anything. It's got that comfortable feel of this is what the site looks like. I mean, that all that scene in the opening, that's brilliant to me, you know. And them down in the pit digging and finding the skull and stuff and explaining that it's fossilized, you know. Everyone looks right. The settings are therefore right because it's, as I say, in the time. So it's perfect.
Hammer movies were very much of their period. I mean, same as, you do get these eras, like, you know, the aforementioned Universal period, and then you get the Hammer. Do you think they've had their time, or do you think there's always room for a kind of resurgence of well-told studio-led horror? I mean, I know we have Blumhouse at the minute, but it's kind of an eclectic thing. I believe Laurie Brewster has just reformed Amicus to kind of go that old Hammer... Get that Hammer vibe.
I'm all for that. I mean, because modern seems to have taken it as far as it can. So why don't we take a few steps back?
Nice. I mean, we're coming to the crux of the matter here. This one is regarded as a cult classic. Do you personally think it deserves that label? Or do you think the term cult kind of devalues it somewhat?
It's narrowing it down to a bunch of people who, in a way, they feel, you know, it's just this bunch. But I think anyone who watched it could get some feeling of, as I said, that whole sense of it could happen. Mm. Anyone who's, you know, so it's not so much cult might be, to me, devaluing it a bit in that it makes it sound like it's something it isn't.
Yeah.
It's not cut off from people in general. Anyone could watch this and think, oh, wow, that's good. I've never seen that. And that's something I really would like to, you know, learn more about what this writer did, because Nigel Neill was a great writer.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
And I would actually say, regardless of whether it's a cult classic, it's also a classic. It's a great movie.
Definitely. Which, I mean, brings me to the question, what is it about this one personally that grips you? Is there an aspect that gives you the shivers? And, you know, just to clarify, that can be anything from a technical aspect to a purely personal emotional connection. What is it that does it for you?
And there are so many things that just speak to me in it. It's, I think I've covered a number of them, in that it's got to it, the sound, the music, the combination of the two, the performances, you know, everything just feels perfect. But above and beyond that, and we haven't touched on this, is actually the cinematography. When you look at the exteriors, say at the church and things like this, there is this beautiful, crisp look to the colors, to the actual lighting, everything. It was interesting to discover that it was actually made at MGM British because, and this isn't film, but this is TV. Another product of that studio had exactly the same look, and that was The Prisoner.
Ah.
The exteriors in that were absolutely stunningly beautiful.
Yeah. Yes.
So, yeah, I'll ask you, Michelle, what is it about the movie that you love?
It's just... I think it scares me. I mean, afterwards, I don't want to go out back because I just have this feeling that there are so many things that could be out there. Seriously, I get it, really freaks me out. And, you know, it's like, I mean, I remember when the first time I heard with the sound that a hedgehog makes, that loud squeal thing, I said to Neil, I'm not going outside. There's something out there. I mean, it's, you know, everything, every little noise that's odd to me, it's like, okay, there's something out there. So this film, I have to watch something else that's fun after it. In fact, I used to watch Kolchak, The Night Stalker. And after that, you know, I'd watch it with my family. Then I'd go upstairs and I'd listen to Dr. Demento until I calmed down and could go to bed. Okay. So this was bound to set me off and think, oh my God, like I say, what if they did dig up something and, you know, it released something? It just sets my writing mind rolling and rolling and thinking of all these things that could happen. And I have to calm down.
Nice. And yet, you know, you've got to say there's not many movies, especially these days, that do that.
Oh, no, you'd have to, for me, you'd have to go to, what's it called? The Haunting Hunt?
The original. Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. Again, a product of MGM British.
Oh, and beautifully filmed and eerie and spooky and, ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I will say, I mean, you know, I've said it before, the writing on this is exceptional.
Oh, yes.
It's fascinating. It's genuinely creepy. And considering, you know, in today's day and age where that is primarily just on conversations between the main characters in just a couple of sets.
Yeah.
To me, that's a testament to Neil's writing, and that's just, I just love that about this film. It grips me, and there's even modern movies, they don't have that same effect.
it's the believability and the what if whole thing, the whole conversations of what if it's, the, you know, it could be this. And, mm-hmm. and you found that's, where did you find that skull? Oh, 3 feet above. Oh, 3 feet above. Oh, dear. You know, it's the whole, the way that conversations do work and lead you to believing this horrible thing that, well, it's not so horrible at first. It's just a matter of, you know, okay, you know, and then but finding out too about the houses that people won't live in. And when you put all of that together, the atmosphere just keeps building and building until there's only one conclusion possible. You know, it's so it's really great.
Nice. Well, that's what we think. But what about you? Once again, you gave us your answers on social media. So I'm going to again hand it over to Vianne to see what you out there in the real world had to say. Vianne, what have you got for us on this one? Have you seen this?
So I always consider myself quite the connoisseur of a good horror film, and this one has been off my radar. So I'm curious to see what everybody is saying about Quartermass in the Pit. Kenneth Barr, absolutely great film. Sean J. Skinner, masterpiece of British sci-fi horror from Hammer Productions, who, as I know, do really great work. And the pen of the great Nigel Neal, love it, totally ahead of its time. Justin Tanner, love this strange and creepy movie. Jason May, love this movie. It's also an inspiration for John Carpenter's Prince of Darkness. Andrew Michael Chapman says, will always be my favorite Hammer film, with The Devil Rides Out a close second. Ryan Manny, a great movie, which definitely still holds up. Greg Cooper, I was able to find this on Blu-ray a few years back. Very scary when it came out. Craig Ballou Dawson, a fantastic film. I have it and the original BBC serial, which is just as good, in my opinion, on Blu-ray. So apparently it's a movie and a serial, so that might be worth comparing. Nick Irwin, absolutely! Exclamation point. The concept is fabulous, and although the special effects look dated now, it is still genuinely creepy in parts. And then Gavin Revitt, I remember watching this whenever it popped up on TV, which usually happened on a Friday night with the Hammer thrillers. I love the nostalgia feel that the movie and how it tackles something with supernatural parallels through a scientific lens. We have the ever-reliable Andrew Keir, Barbara Shelley, and James Donald as the scientist protagonist, and notably a younger Julian Glover who would go on to play General Maximilian Veers in Star Wars, and a younger Gareth Thomas over 10 years before he helmed The Liberator as Rose Blake. I give the movie a 4.5 out of 5 for sheer enthusiasm that the Hammer thrillers often bring. I wonder what would give us that elusive one last half of a star for Gavin, so... Kind of always curious to hear people's nitpicks on these things. But yeah, no, just on the feedback alone, this really makes me want to stop and check out this film. I don't know how I overlooked it, but I think I know what I'm going to be doing this weekend. So with that, back to you, DK.
Thanks as always for that, Vianne. And thank you to everyone who took time out to let us know their thoughts. And like I say, every time, if you think you may have missed out, never fear. We're always open to hearing your opinions, be it in the comments for this one or on our socials. So hit us up and let us know. So yeah, we're at that point again where the shadow of the episode's end looms, which means it's time for our final thoughts. So once more, going to ask this episode's guest for their final mini review and score out of 5. So I'm going to come to you first on this, Michelle. I think I have a feeling where this is going. What would you say about Quatermass and the Pit and your final score out of 5?
Okay, I think that had they not got Nigel Neal to write it, it wouldn't have been what it is, and that he did a brilliant job of tracing his miniseries into this movie and keeping the salient points and dragging us along through this build-up to the horror at the end, because it's not really a horror film, but more psychological and yet all ruled up. And that I give it a 5 out of 5, and I think it's absolutely brilliant and thoughtful and perfectly performed.
Nice.
Next.
Neil.
For me, it's just a real statement of and state of the art of great storytelling, atmosphere, compelling. Wow. It's just the most amazing film, really. And yeah, definitely two thumbs up for me, and five stars.
Five. Okay. I feel like I'm going to be a dissenting voice in this, and now I feel terribly guilty. Yeah, I'm just Run saying it looks slightly dated just by when and where it's set, but it's only slightly. The special effects still kind of hold up for the most part, even though they're very much of the time. But in general, it's a genuinely creepy hour and a half, and it grips you from the opening scene and never lets go. When one thinks of Hammer, one instinctively thinks of Christopher Lee, Peter Cushing, Gothic Horror, Al. Yet this small group of players, together with Neil's exceptional writing, evoke an atmosphere that is unmatched. It's slow, perhaps even ponderous, but not for a moment is it boring. What makes this even more impressive is that it's primarily focuses on science rather than the supernatural, and that imbues the piece with an element of verisimilitude that places it a step above the other horror thrillers that have long ago faded into memory. Considering most of the action takes place in pretty much one location, and it still takes a hold of you, it gives an idea just how captivating the premise and the execution of the premise are. It's not perfect. Some of the minor characters lapse into the occasional stereotype, but to me, it's almost flawless. It's intriguing, it's unsettling, it's Lovecraftian in its approach to the unknown, and it is incredibly creepy. To my mind, it's far better than what many would consider horror today, and I've given it 4.5 out of 5. So, yeah, I feel like I've let the side down here.
Neil, that's up to your star rating that you said earlier, haven't you, hon?
Yeah, I have, actually. I had given it a 4.5, honestly, but I didn't know you were going to do half marks. I've reviewed my opinion since we've been discussing it and thinking, yeah, actually, it is a 5-star movie.
There's no problem with that whatsoever. I mean, which means after collating those scores, quite a mass in the pit. I mean, it receives a final cult classic score of 4.8 out of 5, which, I mean, I think that's pretty decent. So. Yeah. Yeah, there's no shame there on your part, Neil. Maybe on mine, but I think that's one of the high scores we've had on Cult Classics so far, and I think it's well deserved for this one. I think this one holds up incredibly well. So yeah, that's it for today. All that's left to do is to thank my guests. So Michelle, Neil, thank you for joining us today, and thank you for such an interesting conversation.
I'm always good
always,
for
always, and I look forward to doing it again sometime.
Have you enjoyed it? Oh, definitely.
Yes.
Yeah, it's been great. So as I mentioned early in the episode, you can catch Michelle and Neil's Destination Yesterday podcast wherever you get your podcast. Once again, I'll urge you to check it out, and you know, I will reiterate that we will put the link in the description. But before we go, is there anywhere else the listeners can find you? Any more projects you wanted to promote, or perhaps any social media when you can be found?
Let's see. Destination Yesterday is on Facebook. That's about it. I'm too busy writing to keep things updated well, so just follow us there as far as I know. Is that about all?
Absolutely. Huh? That's a good place to find out what we're up to. We are diversifying. We are going to be issuing our audiobook of Eldritch Horror, which will be effectively a collection of tales from the Cthulhu mythos by H.P. Lovecraft primarily, but also featuring stories from writers like Frank Belknap Long, Clark Ashton Smith, Robert E. Howard, Robert W. Chambers. So, you know, it's going to be a mixed bag, and everything is being read by members of the cast of Eyes for Investigate. So it's kind of like us coming home, as it were, to our influences.
Nice.
And you'll be able to find out about that through the Destination Yesterday page on Facebook.
Yes.
Cool. Well, I'll get that in there. So yeah, we'll put all the links in the description for today's show, so you can find Destination Yesterday. yeah, as usual, as well as our Ko-fi account. Any help to keep these shows running is always appreciated, especially if you enjoy today's show. However, if your budget can't stretch to that, you can always help out in other ways by hitting that like and subscribe button. We would be very glad to have you join us going forward. Speaking of which, if you did enjoy today's episode, I hope you'll consider joining us next week as we continue our month of monsters with the George Romero Stephen King anthology Creepshow. And that promises to be a good one, so I hope we'll see you there. Until then, take care out there, everyone. Stay alert next time you're in the underground. And remember, we are the Martians now. Yes.
You have been listening to The Cult Classics Show, part of the Silver Screen Podcast, created, written, and hosted by TK. Produced by Mike Wilson. Editing by Nick. Feedback section produced by Lady VN. Opening credits by Ian Sanderson. Music by Timeless Journey. Follow us on social media. Links to all of our social media pages can be found on our link tree. This podcast is part of the Mike's Podcast Network, available wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Silver Screen Podcast or Mike's Podcasts. And don't forget to like, subscribe, and share. Thank you for joining us. We hope to see you next time. And remember, no matter where you go, there you are.